what I'm hearing is that as much as we would like to think we are strictly an educational institution and there are other institutions that are there for social services, truth be known, in a lot of districts, we are it. We're it. Sean, you want to say something?
I just want to expand upon, I think Yolanda began earlier talking about collective impact and that strategy of organizing community agencies with schools, and that becomes critical. Mm-hmm. And that existed in Buffalo years ago, and I can say that because I was a student in Buffalo. I grew up on Dodge Street, and I remember walking to St. Anne's for lunch. I remember walking to MLK, School 39, for Light of Schoolhouse. I remember all the services in between my home and those community organizations. Those things no longer exist. And we have a ton of organizations working in silos, competing for the same grant dollars, as opposed to collectively working to support and identify our kids, not just through education, but through mixed income housing and through employment. And that's something that we have to do. In Rochester, the governor has given a ton of money just for that cause. And we have working diligently with local organizations to identify the root cause of the problem and then coalescing around them. And I see some of that same work being able to happen here in Buffalo. Would say yes to starting some of that work, as well as the other mid-sized urban schools. But I think there are ample resources within the community, but we don't leverage them in ways that have the greatest impact on all of our community. So it's a huge issue.
What do you think, David?
Sure. I mean, I'm with Chancellor Rose over here. These are very complex problems. And, you know, we're talking educational equity, but the fact is it doesn't end at the end of a child's educational experience. You know, in Buffalo today, we're patting ourselves on the back a lot, but I promise you, the new jobs, the new restaurants that are opening, the new experiences are not for everyone. And there is nothing more important than for the long-term health and vitality of a community than for opportunity to be for everyone. And you know, education and employment go hand in hand. We can't silo those any longer. Mm-hmm. They have a direct impact. And you know, if you look at our community right now, we've had challenges of equity for a long time. So how are we gonna be smart about fixing those? And you know, in response to the simplistic approach, you know, every day our caseworkers will deal with the kid who's wearing the same dirty t-shirt 4 days in a row. So they go to that house and knock on the door, and then they find out that the family is hungry and the windows are broken. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you have those challenges and you might have a mom working three jobs with kids at three different schools, your math and your English homework aren't all that important. So I think you need a lot of services embedded in a building that can reach out to families, meet them where they are. And it's hard work, and that's ultimately how you're gonna you know, try and fix families' challenges so they can care about what happens with their math and their English homework.
Very good.
And if I'm, you know, an educator in here, I would call the Department of Social Services and see what kind of partnerships you can develop. The last point I'll make is collective impact has proven to work in Buffalo. I mean, every 3 weeks at McKinley High School, Dr. Nevergold, Dr. Harris Tigg, and I sit there with our Commissioner of Social Services, a deputy mayor, three college presidents, both union leaders, the teachers and the administrators, our superintendent and a designee, a parent leader, two foundation leaders. That's hard work for people that have busy jobs, but we find that we are further together. And there's nobody in the middle running that. We'd hold hands and do it together. So, you know, the collective impact, I firmly believe that it gets you further. And Buffalo today is an example of that.
And I just want to add. And so,
yeah, go ahead, Sean.
So the question emphasized being disadvantaged.
Yeah.
And I want to just, I don't want to lose that. Our students come with an enormous amount of skill set and potential. And so these plans can't just be to address the poverty issue, but it also has to help close the opportunity gap. Mm-hmm. So I didn't eat on Elmwood Avenue until I was in college. And I grew up in this city my entire life. And so there are parts of this city of Buffalo that I'm just discovering as an adult. And that can't happen either. We can't fix a problem and keep it in the community. We have to have our students be prepared to live outside of that once they leave high school. And our students, I'm not judging Buffalo, I'm saying my own personal experience, but even in Rochester, our students, yes, we have a booming restaurant industry and a culinary scene, but they're working in the kitchens. They're not the managers, they're not the owners, and they're not the individuals who are involved in the planning of those projects, and that's problematic.
Yeah. Let me shift gears a little. We've been talking about a lot of economic sort of things. Let's talk a little bit about application of equity issues. Black, Latino, and American Indian students are more likely to attend schools with higher concentrations of inexperienced teachers or classes taught by teachers teaching out of their field compared to white and Asian students. What can be done so that all students have access to the best teachers?
Well,
I'll take a crack at it.
Okay.
One thing that I see, and I do a lot of labor relations work, one thing that I see are barriers that are contained in collective agreements which preclude administrators from assigning the best teachers to where they are needed most. That's something that really needs to be addressed. Whether it needs to be addressed systemically or not, I'll leave it for those who have better judgment than I do. But certainly there are specific circumstances in which a superintendent or perhaps a receiver definitely needs to exercise that kind of authority.
Okay. Anyone else want to take a crack at that one?
Well, I think we have to go back to valuing the profession.
Okay.
And you know, there's been so much that it has happened, so many signals, or, you know, our governor in particular has signaled a lack of respect, a lack of valuing for teachers, lack of respecting teachers as professionals.
Right.
I think that some of the mandates regarding teacher evaluation have set teachers up such that putting them in positions or signing them to schools, whatever, that are, quote, failing schools and tying their evaluation and their future their future livelihood or job security to an evaluation that hasn't been proven to be valid is also very problematic.
Barbara, is there a way to make those schools attractive to people to come work?
Well, you know, I would like to see us take a look at the whole high-stakes testing situation that we have in this state, because I think that the accountability measures that are used now in terms of the high-stakes testing essentially create labels for our schools, that we have failing schools, and when you put failing schools or labels on schools that are failing, you put labels on students as failing students, you put labels on teachers as failing teachers, and who wants to go to a, quote, failing school?
Okay.
So I think we need to, you know, really examine. I mean, certainly that's been a major part of a number of conversations that have been, you know, gone on over the last few years.
Okay, so what, I'm gonna keep this question going. What is it we can do to make sure the best teachers are before the kids who need it most?
I think that the issue that we have struggled with this for a long time, and I will say that I know that whether it was in Washington Heights or in my community, I didn't have this problem, but I think I didn't have this problem because we were not in a time when we were bashing teachers, we were celebrating teachers. It was at a time when people returned to their communities to give back. It was at a time when the profession of teaching was one that was highly regarded and a profession that people felt that it was an honor to look at the next generation and prepare.
But I need that teacher to go to that school that needs them.
Okay, well, I think the issue of labels has hurt us.
Okay.
I think the connection of teacher evaluation, the way we have structured it, has hurt us. I think that we definitely need to rethink and go back to honoring this profession, number one. And number two, the fact that we really have to work with our higher ed training colleges in terms of what are the kinds of teachers with all the different skills and content knowledge that are needed to support students in these
schools. Yolanda, do you have trouble recruiting teachers into your schools?
No, we don't.
Why?
We don't have trouble recruiting teachers because our teachers are supported in a way that they know that they're in the classroom to teach. And they are not, when they are confronted with the needs of the students that come with many needs into their classroom, they know that they have partners that can address those needs. And so they're not responsible for that. But they also feel supported in that they are receiving the capacity building that they need. For example, I mean, although we are in a little bit of a competition in terms of our early childhood education teachers who have, you know, left for, you know, higher salaries, we have teachers now. Our early childhood education teachers are coming back to us because they feel more supported in our early childhood education setting because we provide technical assistance. We have a higher teacher to student ratio. We've invested in putting in a family worker and also an assistant teacher to support the classroom because we believe that's what's needed to do. Now, not everyone can do that, but there are other ways that you can invest in capacity building and support in the school, particularly for your teachers, that let them know that they're not only respected, but also they're valued.
Okay, very good.
Hitchhiking on the chancellor's point, which is a more of a global view, I think, as opposed to a very individualized view, that the profession is losing teachers. The statistics are obvious. We're reading about it even in the newspapers.
Yes.
And on top of that, I have the good fortune of teaching school administrators. And there aren't a lot of folks who aspire to the front office anymore either. And that requires as much attention, I think, as our teacher shortage.
Yeah.
And honoring the profession, that's the key. I mean, I do what I do because people appreciate it and they tell me. I think that teachers and administrators deserve the same.
But what I'm concerned about is we might honor the profession, but we're sending them into the front lines where they might not have a chance. And that's, I think, what you guys are trying to get at. It's one thing to honor the profession, but you also have to create the environment, the conditions where they can be successful.
Absolutely. You set them up for failure. You don't want to do that. Yeah. We have to do all of these other things that folks have been talking about. But at the end of the day, that teacher who feels honored going into an environment which is prepared is going to succeed.
Derek, you keep nodding your head like you know all this. Is that true?
Well, this question, like, specifically, actually, is more of a societal marginalization thing. It's not just, like, hiring, but it does have a lot to do with it. It's not about the lack of either. It's actually, like, it's who told these schools that they were failing other than the numbers. It's some students are in there that will be, like, folding under pressure in the classroom will usually be most of the smartest ones or capable to be one of the smartest ones. Okay. And there are like programs that do assist with that, and there are places where they can go. Mm-hmm.
Are you telling me that if you take a test and you don't do well on that test, and the kids in your school don't do well on that test, that school district's not necessarily failing on that one test?
It's not necessarily
failing.
No. I wouldn't blame the student for like its lack of anything.
Right.
It's more likely the test. What are you assessing this child on?
There you go.
There you go. I'm buying that.
Okay. Good answer. I want to ask another question that relates to this way in which we treat people differently. According to research I was reading, Black, Latino, and American Indian students are far more likely to be suspended, expelled, or arrested than their white peers, even when accused of similar behaviors. What should school boards do to address an uneven application of disciplinary practices?
Yeah, I can speak to that.
John?
Our first year at East, we had over 3,000 suspensions for 1,400 kids. And it was a systems response to trying to control our youth. And that was one of the first data points that I saw. And I said, there's deeper issues that we need to address. And most of it is implicit bias. A lot was had to do with systemic racism. And we had to give them a tool to address some of their fears of our students. Right, so I heard you use the word front lines. That's military talk. Some people feared to interact and engage with our students. So we adopted restorative practices as a method, not as an anti-suspension drug, but as an opportunity to restore relationships between and among students, between students and adults, but more importantly, between the adults in the building. Because we had a number of adults who did not like the working conditions they were in because their peers were making it dysfunctional. And so we had to give space for students to articulate their concerns and also things they felt strongly about in their academic experience, but also the adults. And together, that number dropped from 3,000 to less than 700 in a year. And it wasn't because we hid suspensions, it's because we weren't suspending kids for non-suspendable offenses. You know, a kid skips school, you don't suspend them for 5 days. Right. You know, if a kid has his pants below his waist, you don't suspend them for 2 days. You don't suspend a kid for saying the F word, because you go to any suburban school, and I worked in two, you hear the same thing. And so we had this new standard of discipline and control that impeded our students' ability to be in school, in seats, to learn. Mm-hmm. And so I think school boards, again, I think they have to align. First, unpack what their true beliefs are around this matter, and then align their practices to that.
Do you think that the behaviors themselves changed at all because of this new approach?
I do. I mean, I think that there are still some in the building who probably think we're too light, and there's some who think at times we're too heavy. But I do think that the teachers felt empowered to make, as you said, common sense decisions around our youth. And they weren't beholden to a policy that said you must suspend the first time for a day, the second time 3 days, the third time the 5 days, and every time out was 5 days. Our students walked around. This is the running joke with our students, said at some point around beds day, they would say this. That would be their, every offense, they put this up. So what is that? 5 days, automatically, 5 days. Mm-hmm. We had kids who had 15 5-day suspensions. Mm. I mean, it's ridiculous. And so I would say that it's a policy, a practice, and belief issue. Yeah. The process could be restored to practice, but the community as a whole, the board, must challenge the norm to ask the deep questions. Why are our students being suspended at disproportionately?
Chancellor?
I think there's also some of the messages, subtle messages that we send out. I visit many schools. When I walk into a school that has metal detectors, it immediately sends a message. When I walk into schools that, for whatever reason, there are kinds of, you know, the building doesn't look like the kind of place that anyone sitting in this room would ever even imagine sending your very own to. Mm. That sends another message. So I think that we have this notion, beyond just the suspension issue, we have this notion of this is good enough for these students, and this is good enough for somebody else's kid. And I think in this equity conversation, we've got to get to a place where we talk about what's good enough for all of our children. If it's not good enough for you to put your very own, it isn't good enough to put somebody else's. And in my opinion, that there are just these incredible signals, whether we consciously realize it or not, that we send out when we visit these schools, when the students exist in these schools, these very strange signals that pretty much say to the students, you know what, we've got to corral you, we've got to contain you. Instead of building self-discipline, instead of building the kinds of skills that kids feel good about their environment, feel good about their behavior, and feel very much a part of the system, but rather, you know, whenever I hear the pipeline, in many ways we have places that establish the pipeline very early on.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, what would you say to that?
Well, I agree very much so, and I think with four of my fellow board members here, agreeing with Sean on the reasons why kids are kicked out, why they're suspended, one of them that is onerous is insubordination. So we find that all the time. Well, what does that mean? Well, they talk back. They used a curse word. They rolled their eyes at me. You know, they looked at me funny. So we do, and as policymakers, and we look at our code of conduct, and we ask for the data. Where's the data? You know, why are these kids being suspended? How many are being suspended? How often are they being suspended? So as a board member, it is incumbent upon us to look at the data, to follow the data, ask the questions. But also, you know, at times, you know, we're not a monolithic in agreement on our board. And so we have a board member who says, we should have more, you know, we should throw these kids out. We should get the police in. And that's a, you know, that's a reality in that, at least in our board, that we have to struggle with as well while we're trying to manage and, you know, really have substantive discussions and look at the data so we can inform our policies around that. We also have to deal with the biases within our own district and within our own board.
Mike, you come from, how many students in your school district?
We have approximately 1,300.
About 1,300, it's a rural district.
Yes.
Do you have these kind of issues of differentiation as far as discipline? Do you feel that there's biases in that regard?
Well, we keep it simple.
Okay. I think we know the mission. Yeah.
1,300? You can keep it simple.
That's right. And here's what I would say to that in terms of the 1,300. I think it's important to realize that, sure, Buffalo is different than Wilson, no question about it. But kids are the same. And kids have needs and wants that I think are the same. We definitely have different culture in terms of Wilson, New York, and Buffalo, New York. But what we have to do is take a look at what works. Because we have poverty. We have kids who go home to no plumbing. We have kids who live with no heat. They have a wood stove. So I believe that we are all faced with our mountains to climb in terms of disadvantaged children. And let's take a look at where it works. And for us, you know, there are a number of things, but when it comes to discipline, I think we need to look at a systemic issue in terms of why are the kids misbehaving? And what can we institute to help reduce those significant issues? And if we do that first, and I think Carl alluded to this in terms of you know, our expectations and sometimes our biases, what we expect is what we're going to get. And if we don't properly train our staff, which includes, you know, support staff, teachers, and administration, to have an expectation in terms of performance, then kids feel valued differently, and of course, behavior becomes a problem.
Yeah, very good. Let me gauge this the audience for the depth of another problem. The State Education Department requires districts to offer bilingual programs if they if there are more than 20 students in a grade who share a language other than English. By a show of hands, how many of your districts are having difficulty finding language teachers to meet this requirement? Quite a few. Okay, so panel, given the audience's indication that language teachers are hard to find, what can we do to accomplish this goal? Anybody?
Hello.
Are you going to tell us that in Spanish?
Well, actually, given the audience, I'm going to take a chance and say, lo que se, la gente que se propone puede tener éxito. Okay, so let me translate. Again, having come here when I was 10 years old, I did not have a bilingual program, but I certainly had a lot of support. And I would say that, you know, the one theory I always have is that you don't find, a lot of times that you will look, but it's almost like sometimes people will say, I can't find this. Did you look in the right places? Did you really create conditions to train? Did you think futuristic about some of the conversions and some of the ways that you could attract? Did you really work on a recruitment retention process? So there are many options that people engage in to fulfill an obligation. And so I would submit that we have a challenge, there's no question about it. But given this challenge, I will tell you, and I'm looking at a superintendent that I know not only has a bilingual but a dual program, that there are people who want to do this work and do this work in a way that is thoughtful and in a way that's responsive to children that are coming to this country with needs for second language.
Do certification programs get in the way?
Certification programs absolutely get in the way, but they also get in the way because when we don't signal, here's an issue. When the signal is weak about, yes, we need this, but it's a weak signal. It's not a strong signal saying, we truly need this and we're gonna do something about it. As long as the signal is weak, we tend to talk about the excuses. We can't find it, we can't do it, we can't. I would submit that we have an obligation to begin early on with recruiting, with training, with support at the higher ed level, as well as finding solutions. Because let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen,
10 years from now, they're going to be 50% of the population. And I think that we've got to plan for what is going to be.
Well, let's see if we have the group to do that. How many of you came here from another country speaking another language?
What? Well, wait a minute. Another country, Puerto Rico, is considered a commonwealth.
Okay, excuse me. Someplace other than the 50 states and spoke another language. And I admire you. I've often thought, what would that be like to come someplace, not be able to speak the language, and be expected
Absolutely.
To communicate and learn
Absolutely.
And things like that? I really
Very
do admire
true.
You. And we need you at the board table. In the administrative ranks, because it's very important to have people who can have felt that experience and can empathize.
And language, and it's not
and
just cultural. There are cultural issues. You know, we were talking about we haven't mentioned the word cultural differences.
Right.
We have a dominant culture that has certain behavioral expectations. And school is not sometimes the place that we make those adjustments for different cultures. And by culture and race, we do have some places where we have direct language, as Lisa Delpa talks about, an indirect language. And so when you have young people who say, give it to me straight, we have difficulty with that. But that is a cultural, that is a language. So if you look at the culture in this country of African American, there is a culture, there is a language that's connected to that. Schooling sometimes doesn't honor that. And in many situations, we have the rub, if you will, because we are not understanding, because the for the most part, the European culture is very indirect. You are not in my, you will say something about, I am having difficulty distinguishing what's yours from mine. In the direct culture, you would say, that's stealing. So there are indirect and direct. For those of you who are involved with Common Core, you should have gotten that. Indirect versus direct. So I just want to point out that culture is so important.
Absolutely. And we think that's very, and you know what, this whole conversation keeps telling me that we have before us a school model that's a box. Mm-hmm. And it worked for a long time, and it still works in some places, but we're starting to realize that this box is no longer the box we need.
Right.
And we're going to have to do some redesigning here.
Absolutely.
Fundamental redesigning. One of the things that comes into play as we discuss about equity is the use of technology. So I have a question. How does the use of technology, let's say as like online learning or things of that nature, provide students in poorer or more remote school districts a more equitable educational opportunity? Mm-hmm. Or does it not at all? Yes, Derek.
Well, as everybody knows, and this is not really common sense, online learning is more of a universal thing. It's pretty much puts you in a basis where you don't have to, you're in the same level of competition with somebody who's aiming for the same college you're in or school that you're trying to go to. For example, say I want to go to Howard, and this guy, Asian, came in from Asia, you know, he has gotten standardized learning from over there and meets the criteria, and I've received online learning that both meets the criteria, we both match.
So you think it levels the playing field a little bit?
It levels the playing field for a poor person to kind of compete with
So it's a good thing?
Yes.
Okay. Hey. Use of technology. Anybody over here?
Yeah, in regards to technology, and I like your comments about culture. I think that's extremely important because technology teaches history, not his story. So I think it's extremely important to know that when we're able to access technology, we're able to go out and to find things that interest us, are culturally representative of our own families. Mm-hmm. And we all know that when the cultural representation in the school is high of the population, Absolutely. Learning improves.
I was putting my questions together here, and somebody came to me and said, you know, there's a lot of research out there that say boys and girls learn differently. And that's an equity issue. And I hadn't thought of this. And so the question I've got is, if boys and girls learn differently, and we don't need to go into all those philosophies, but do you think educating boys and girls separately promotes gender equity and optimizes learning? No.
I'm with you, kid. Right?
it's not like that.
That's direct, right?
But seriously.
Keep it simple.
No, if you're going to generalize in that way, why go based off of gender? Gender is a kind of a vague, very broad term to actually even base learning off of, really.
Do boys and girls get treated differently in your school?
It's hard to say. Not really.
Not really? Okay.
Not really, but I'm a boy. Yeah. So it's like, I don't know how a girl gets treated differently.
Yeah, right. You know? But you would definitely don't see this.
It
wouldn't be better if you were in a school with all boys. A girls' school was across the street, and it wouldn't be a better learning experience?
I wouldn't see it as, different, really.
It's, okay.
You know, some girls learn.
It's not the issue for you. Right. Yeah. Yes. Barbara?
I don't know in general the question, but I do know, I think about a year ago or so, we were talking with our students about sex education. And we asked the question of them, would you prefer to have your sex education class as a co-ed class or as a single gender class? And surprise, the answer came back, we'd like it to be a single gender class because there are things that we would like to discuss among ourselves as girls that we wouldn't want to discuss with the young men and vice versa. So, you know, maybe again, going back to the students and asking on particular issues, yes.
But only that class was the only one under question.
That was the one that was under discussion.
Yeah, okay.
So that was the feedback we got from them.
Right. I think we kind of look at it as an access issue, that you want to make sure that the opportunities that are available to one gender are available to both, to all. So, for example, you know, we have, you know, STEM classes. We have a bicycle workshop. And if you walk into those classes, you're not going to see, you know, either boys or girls, you're gonna see a really good mixture. You know, we have a partnership with Alvinelli, and you know, some of the better dancers are the young men that are in the class. So it's like what are the opportunities that you're opening up to both and allowing that to happen and ensuring that access is up front.
Do you think there's a downside to having the genders separated?
I don't think there's a downside. I do think that there are times when that is needed, and I do agree, particularly. You know, we do a lot of reproductive health work with adolescents, and you want to make sure that you provide the best environment possible to ensure that that young person can thrive and develop their best selves. And it depends. And so I don't want to sit here and say that you need to do one or the other. It's more about access. And if the need is there to provide gender-specific opportunities, it's because the data showed that. The conversations with young people and our parents or the community showed that, but not because, you know, anything else.
Do you think, I'm going to ask this of the panel, do you think having people in your schools who are culturally different, people who speak different languages, has advantages for the school environment?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I think that's important. But you also want to make sure that people care regardless of who they are. And I think that goes even a longer way, because you can have people who look like you, but if they don't care, then, I mean, it's like, why is that person there? So I think for young people, they, you know, they call it like they see it. They know who cares, and they know who to go to in the school who will have their best interests at heart. And I think that's what we want. We want to make sure that people in the school, from my perspective, care and have the best interests of the child.
I think globalization is doing that for us anyway. That's number one. Number two,
I like the
idea. But not everywhere. Well, you made the point of segregation before. Six of the 50 most segregated cities in this country are in New York State.
Absolutely. And that is why the more we work on this issue, the idea of preparing our kids. But I want to go back to I like the idea of being in a class where young men, as we had the architectural mm-hmm. class, right? A lot of my young women, young girls, were in the drafting architectural design class that we had at 218. It was so amazing that young men could see these young women as talented. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we separate, we are sending another soft signal that says, you know what? This is good enough for this group and not good enough for this group. When we integrate, when we're inclusive, we send the signal of saying, wow, Susie is so amazing in the area of chemistry. Bobby is so amazing as my dancer in the Alvin Ailey production. I think kids see that and realize that if they had any hesitation about a particular field, that it encourages them because they have other models to pursue that.
Let's give education in New York State some credit. Take a look at Kate Switzer, the first woman to complete a marathon. Mm-hmm. One of our great success stories is Title IX. And would Title IX have happened had kids been segregated? I don't know. I don't have that answer. But certainly when we put everybody together and our females said to themselves, hey, I want to run, let them run.
Yeah, very good.
Let them run.
Very good. I'm going to we have just a couple minutes. I want to see if anybody out there has a question that they want to pose to this panel. Just raise your hand. Mike?
Yes. Yeah, first of all, I want to thank everybody for your comments. And I think it was very thought-provoking and very, very good. But unless I'm mistaken, the one key element that seems to be missing was that of the family and the parents in the education mm-hmm. of the children. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'd like your feedback. Mm-hmm. You know, how much is our fault, quote, and what about the family?
So for us at Children's Aid, children come with families. They don't come without families, whether they are two parent, uncles, aunties. They come with families. And so the work that we do not only engages the child, but engages the parent as well. And so we are very intentional about the work that we do with families. And so we not only have designated spaces in our community schools where parents can go during the school day to do what they need to do. They take their own classes, whether it's high school equivalency, ESL, learning about business, because a lot of them have small businesses. But we also allow them the opportunity to network with one another, and we also provide them opportunity to support their child during the school day. Because for a lot of families that we work with that come from countries from outside of the United States, they've not engaged with the school system in the way that we ask them to or we want them to here. And so we provide them with the skill set to do so. So we provide them with the understanding of what executive functioning skills look like and how do you support that in the house. And they appreciate that because as we educate them about how they can support their child outside of the school day, that increases their investment in the school and investment in their child and investment in themselves.
Okay, I'm getting the high sign over here, I think. And first of all, let's give our panel a round of applause.